Welcome to JudgeCast North. I'm your host, Charlotte Sable. I'm a level 2 judge from Guelph, Ontario, Canada. Joining me tonight to discuss Commander 2013 and its new cards and fun stuff is Joe Bono, level 2 judge from the Seattle area.
Hi, Charlotte. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you for coming on. So some of the listeners might know Joe as a contributor to, at times, to Limited Resources. But beyond that, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, Joe?
So like you said, I'm a local L2 judge in the Seattle area. I occasionally judge a PTQ, but mostly I do in-store events and work with some of the community here and mentoring new L1s and aspiring L1s. One of the things that's great about Seattle is that we've got this wealth of judges in the community. We've got 3 or 4 L3s and a whole bunch of L2s, and so there's never a demand for a judge, and so I like to sort of target my work towards the community and towards local stores.
Well, that's good. I mean, yeah, it's always nice when you don't feel like, oh, I have to go judge this GPT this weekend. Oh, man, I wish I could just stay home, you know? Or, oh, man, I'd really like to play this PTQ, but they need me to judge it.
Yeah, it's pretty rare that I have to struggle with that, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm, you know, as you mentioned, I'm a regular contributor to Limited Resources. I appear 4 times a year on that. And you can go ahead and go to lrcast.com if you want to listen to the Limited Resources podcast. I'm in each of the Judge Joe Bono does mechanics for blah set reviews that they have.
Yeah, so it's probably pretty similar to what we do with our pre-release specials here. When
exactly.
We talk about the cards and the rules, though. I'm not sure. You probably are more talking about functionally for Limited, where we talk about constructed applications and that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, that's very true.
Okay. Anyway, so let's get right into it. So Commander 2013 is coming out on November 1st. It's coming out as 5 pre-constructed decks, each 100 cards, obviously, because they're Commander decks. So there's no random cards. There's no booster packs. You know, if you want Commander 2013, you have to buy the decks. The decks are all the same, well, among the 5 colors. The 5 decks are each within 1 color, and it's 2 allied colors. So there's basically the same as the Shards of Alara. So there's, you know, Esper, Naya, Jund, Bant, Grixis, you know, those 5.
Yep. And these are really...
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, like, these are very exciting products. The last time they did a Commander product like this, there were some interesting cards for other formats, but there are also a lot of great cards for Commander. And one of the really nice things about these products is that they reprint a lot of cards that, you know, are old and may not see as much play and sort of re-expose them to people. And I like in this set that they have a pretty significant theme of cards from the Portal 3 Kingdoms set.
It's neat to see some of those cards, just because even though some of them might be functionally the same as some of the other cards, they'll have very interesting sort of flavor to them. Like, one of my favorite cards that was reprinted in this set is Borrowing 100,000 Arrows.
Yeah.
Just because that card has an amazing name, you know? I mean, there's a functional variant of it called, I don't know, Dream something. Anyway, it does exactly the same thing, but it's not as cool as Borrowing 100,000 Arrows.
It's an awesome name.
Yes. Anyway, so hopefully if you're listening to this show, you know what Commander is, but if not, let's give a basic overview. So Commander, you're playing a 100-card deck. One of those 100 cards is a legendary creature. That creature's color identity, which is the colors of any of the colors in its mana cost, plus any mana symbols that appear in its text that aren't reminder text, that defines the Commander's color identity. Every card in your deck has to be of the command of the same color of a can't be outside of your Commander's color identity. So let's say, for example, you're playing, you know, a mono red Commander. You can't play a red creature that has a white activated ability, for example.
Yeah, so if we're playing Godo Bandit Warlord as our Commander, who's a mono red Commander, we can't play like Boros Guild Mage, which, you know, has hybrid mana and its mana cost and it has a white activated ability in it.
Right, exactly. Yes, so hybrid does count, all of that. All right. So, but I mean, that's the basics, and you build your deck from that. You can only have one of any given card except for basic lands. There's a ban list, but that's at, what, mggcommander.com?
Yep. And yeah. that's more of a sort of like community-driven ban list that, you know, they encourage you within your playgroup, if you find a card to be oppressive, to just say, let's ban that for our playgroup. And if you want to play with one of the cards on their ban list, they say, hey, it's your game. You should have fun.
Yeah, like maybe people, you know, are very fairly getting to 15 mana and casting Emrakul, you know, or whatever, right? Like, who knows?
Yep.
Exactly.
The one other thing to note with Commander is that it utilizes the command zone, and that's where your commander card starts every game. And there's a special rule for your commander card that anytime you could cast it from your hand, you can cast it from the command zone. And if your commander goes to the graveyard or goes to exile, you can put it in the command zone, and then you can recast it again. But each time you cast it, you have to spend 2 more mana than you did before, which we'll see has rules implications for some of the cool commanders that they've printed in this set.
Right. So each of the 5 decks comes with 2 new commanders. Well, comes with 2 new creatures in that color and 1 reprinted creature in those colors. So any of the 3 can serve as a commander at any point when you're playing, if you're playing those decks as is. So don't feel like you're locked into playing one or the other or whatever. You know, and if, say, you have a Mael of the Anima deck, and you say, like, today I think I'll play, you know, Marath as my commander instead of Mael. You know, you can just put Mael into the deck and pull Marath out, and there you go. You're good to go. Right?
Yeah.
As long as they have the same color identity.
Exactly.
All right. So anyway, so there are 51 new cards. These cards are all legal Magic cards for tournament play. As soon as the set comes out, they'll be legal in Commander, they'll be legal in Vintage, and they'll be legal in Legacy. They will not be legal in Modern or in Standard. That's important to note. Any of them, of course, that are reprints of standard legal cards or modern legal cards will be playable in those formats, but the new cards will not be legal in those formats.
Yeah, so this set doesn't change the legality of any card. Whatever format was in legal in before, it's legal in now, but it doesn't add to the legality.
Right, this is what they call a supplemental product. So, all right, so let's go over the new cards. We'll start with white, because this isn't a 4-hour podcast, so we can start at the beginning every time. All right, Active Authority. So that's an enchantment for 1/2 white. When Active Authority enters the battlefield, you may exile, target, artifact, or enchantment. And at the beginning of your upkeep, you may exile, target, artifact, or enchantment. If you do, its controller gains control of Active Authority. So, the controller, you'll only have to give its control of Active Authority over if the artifact or enchantment is actually exiled. If it, you know, becomes an illegal target, or if for some reason it can't be exiled, if there's something weird going on.
Yep, or if you just choose not to use the ability.
Yeah.
So every upkeep, it is going to target something, but you don't have to choose that thing.
Right.
You don't have to choose to use the ability then. And this is a card that kind of, we see this in a bunch of the commander cards that, you know, it slowly kills a bunch of permanents of a different type, and it does it in a kind of fair manner in that different people get to choose those things.
Right.
But the person who casts it first gets to do it twice.
Right. And, of course, one thing to also note, it doesn't say another target. So it can, if you really don't like this card and your opponent's, like, gotten rid of your thing and given it to you, you can just have it exile itself and be done.
Yeah, so, like, if you've got a Bant Auras deck or a Bant, you know, or some other, like, enchantment-focused deck and your opponent casts this.
They're all one of those guys, yeah.
Yeah, your opponent casts this and kills 2 things, you can say, all right, we'll just exile this Active Authority.
Because, yeah. All right, what would be next? I guess Curse of the Forsaken?
Yeah, so the curse subtype is a returning mechanic from Innistrad block, and it's a subtype that only goes with enchantment auras, and when you cast one of these, you target a player and you enchant them with it. So we have one in each of the colors, and the one in white is Curse of the Forsaken. It says, enchantment aura curse, enchant player. Whenever a creature attacks enchanted player, its controller gains 1 life. And so these are detrimental enchantments that you put on your opponent.
The effects of all the curses, they're all pretty straightforward. Just note that you control it, not the person it's enchanting. All of the ones in the commander set do trigger off of the enchanted player being attacked. So, yeah.
And you also are going to control the trigger, which becomes important when we talk about the blue one a little bit later on.
Right.
So we'll talk about that one.
Right. We'll get there. All right. So Darksteel Mutation is next. That's an aura, enchantment aura for one and a white, enchant creature. Enchanted creature is a 0/1 insect artifact creature with indestructible and loses all of their abilities, card types, and creature types. So this card actually did receive errata that makes it different from how it was printed in the set. It doesn't say that it loses other card types and creature types, and this is actually a functional difference, but most people probably wouldn't see it that way. So they're just trying to basically bring it in line with the way most people would read it.
Yeah, so usually when you change the subtype or type of something, it will lose the other subtypes of that go into the same thing, or the other types
If it doesn't say in addition to its other types.
Right. So like when Blood Moon says all non-basic lands are mountains, it also means they lose all their other subtypes.
Right. And they lose their abilities and whatnot. But yes.
Yeah, but there's this rule. It's 205.1b that says that if something turns something into an artifact creature, it actually keeps its other types.
Yeah, it's just a weird exception based on old cards and...
Yeah, but anyways, they errated this so that the way players are going to read it, they're going to make the right assumptions about it, and it's important for all the listeners here because we're all smart judges and a lot of people are going to, that listen to this podcast specifically know about
the artifact creature exception.
About the artifact creature exception and know that this errata exists. So this is also an interesting card because it deals with layers. You know, it's going to be acting in layer 4 to change the type, and in layer 6, and it's also going to be acting in layer 7b, and layer 6 is where it removes the abilities and adds the indestructibility.
Yeah.
And then in layer 7b is where it sets the card type.
Right. Again, the main thing to understand with this card is that it has this errata, and so it's actually a lot simpler now than it was before.
Yeah. It's also worth noting that it doesn't change the color of it. A lot of players tend to assume that anything that's an artifact is colorless, but you will retain the color on this.
Yeah. Unless it has a color-defining, characteristic-defining ability, although that actually would apply before it loses the ability. Though there actually aren't that many of those anymore because of color indicators. But
yeah,
we can get into that another time. That's one of those pieces of Magic trivia that I have in the back of my head of how many cards actually have color-defining abilities still.
But yeah, that was a favorite judge stumper of mine when Innistrad Block first came out.
Yeah.
To talk about, like, Dryad Arbor and how it's been functionally changed and stuff like that.
So, Mystic Barrier is next. You want to read this one, Joe?
Yeah, it's an enchantment for 4 and a white. It says, when Mystic Barrier enters the battlefield or at the beginning of your upkeep, choose left or right. Each player may attack only the opponent seated nearest him or her in the last chosen direction, and Planeswalker is controlled by that player.
Yay, awkward wordings.
Yeah, so you choose left or right, and you can only attack left or attack right when you're choosing an opponent. There are some game types where it's not actually going to be the person immediately to your left or right, because that person might be a teammate.
Or just not an opponent, like if you're playing Star or whatever.
Right. Well, technically in Star, the people that you're allied with are your teammates. Yeah.
Except but, you don't win or lose as a team in that format. But yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you're playing clockwise or counterclockwise. You just choose left or right. The one interesting case with Mystic Barrier is what happens if there are two Mystic Barriers out. If there are two Mystic Barriers out and they've chosen opposite directions.
Yeah. One's on left and one's on right. What happens?
Yeah. Most of the time, nobody's going to be able to attack unless the opponent that's closest to you on the left is also the opponent that's closest to you on the right.
Which would mean it's down to two players.
Or that, like, there's some weird multiplayer game where there's one person on one side and, like, teammates or something like that.
Maybe, like, Emperor or something.
Yeah. And this doesn't override rules in Emperor games and other variants that have other restrictions about which direction you can attack. So, like, if you're playing an Emperor and you're the lieutenant on the right and somebody plays Mystic Barrier and says left, you're not going to be able to attack anybody because your closest opponent on the left is two people away and you're only allowed to attack the person who's immediately adjacent to you that's an opponent.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. That one's pretty easy normally. It's when you get two that it gets kind of weird, but yeah.
Yeah.
That's one thing I actually really like about these sorts of sets. It lets them print these kind of weird things that they wouldn't necessarily put in a regular set, or they necessarily can't, because it's sort of multiplayer focused, and it's not necessarily commander focused, but it's, you know, there's all this multiplayer design space that they don't get to tap into a lot.
Yeah, and like the last sort of mainstream set that really did any of this multiplayer sort of stuff was Future Sight, where they had a couple things that like created token copies of enchantments for your teammates and stuff like that.
Mask and yeah.
And I think they realized that like that's a lot of complexity that just isn't worth putting in mainstream sets. And so when they get to do these sets, they open up the floodgates on that. And like a lot of these cards are very wordy, but when you actually play them, they're actually going to make a lot of sense despite being very wordy, because while it may take some text to put into rules-y's what you're trying to do, they make a lot of sense when you actually try to do the thing.
Right. It's like, oh, I can only attack left. Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
So next up, we've got Serene Master. It's one and a white for a creature human monk. Whenever Serene Master blocks, exchange its power and the power of target creature is blocking until end of combat. And it's a 0/2.
All right. So this ability obviously applies in the second sublayer of power and toughness, where abilities that set power and toughness specific values are set. However, it will look at the total power and toughness when exchanging them. Also, if one of them isn't there anymore, nothing's exchanged. Not that it matters, because it ends at end of combat. But anyway, it's a weird little ability, but I mean, it's not all that complicated. It basically means, but like, let's say Serene Master has 2/1/1 counters on it, so it's a 2/4.
Yep.
And it blocks a
3/3. Yeah.
Sure. So it blocks my Kanan Minotaur. So why don't you explain what happens?
Okay, so Serene Master blocks the Kanan Minotaur. It's going to target that with the ability.
Right.
Serene Master's base power is going to become 3 in layer 7B.
Yeah.
And then in layer 7D, the bonus from the counters is going to be applied, and so its power is going to go up to a 5. Meanwhile, the Kanan Minotaur is going to exchange its power with the calculated power of Serene Master before you apply this exchange. So it's going to become a 2. And this becomes even a little bit weirder if there is some power and toughness boosting effect on the Kanan Minotaur. So if Serene Master with 2+1/+1 counters was blocking a Kanan Minotaur that was
giant growth.
Yeah, that was giant growth. So we'd start out with a 6/6 Kanan Minotaur and a 2/4 Serene Master, and then the Serene Master would become a 8/4, and then the Kanan Minotaur is going to become a 5/6.
Yeah, which is weird, but yeah, it's an interesting place. They don't play it a lot, but luckily it doesn't have a whole lot. This is just limited to the combat, so it's not going to make too many complicated things.
Yeah, this is actually a great example of a card that you could not print in a regular set because you would not want this to ever be in a limited format because it would just cause too much confusion.
Well, yeah, well, like the last time they did anything like this, which was on Tree of Redemption, that was Mythic, so yeah.
Yeah, and that was only just exchanging toughness. It didn't do anything with power. You can't have this in a format with tricks and enchantments that you put on
stuff.
Yeah,
like, this card in Theros would just be completely mind-blowing, so.
Yeah, it would confuse a lot of people, but it's great to put in Commander because most of the Commander players are not going to encounter this because only power and toughness boosting things that you really have in most Commander decks are, you know, some equipment. And you're not going to have like a lot of combat
tricks. Maybe some auras, maybe, you know, some anthem effects, whatever.
Right.
But it's also actually a really good card to help teach layers to people, so.
Yeah, it's a great example for, you know, rules advisors that are looking to become an L1 judge and, like, really talking through what's going on the sublayers of 7.
Yeah. All right, so Tempt with Glory. Tempt with Glory is part of a cycle, which has a ability word called Tempting Offer. Ability words are things like Battalion or... What was the one from Dark Ascension? I mean, Morbid's also an ability word. Any of the words that appear
Landfall.
In Landfall, right. Abilities that are linked, that appear in italics, but don't have an intrinsic rules meaning.
Yeah. They're basically like signifiers to say, hey guys, these cards kind of do similar things. In Theros, Heroic is the one that they use, but they don't always do exactly the same
thing. It's just that in the past they printed abilities that were similar, but people didn't tend to notice them because there was other stuff going on the cards, and yeah. They wanted to like, hey look, this is, you know, kind of a thing that happens. We'll talk about Tempt with Glory, but with the discussion we'll go into how all of the Tempting Offer cards work, because they all work the same way. So, Tempt with Glory, 5 and a white, sorcery, Tempting Offer. Put a 1-1 counter on each creature you control. Easy enough, right? Okay, all my guys get a 1-1 counter.
Yep.
Each opponent may put a 1-1 counter on each creature he or she controls. So each opponent, in APNAP order, like, so starting from you, whoever would take the next turn decides, and that, then the next player, then the next player, then the next player, etc., can put a 1-1 counter on each creature he or she controls. Then, for each opponent who chose to put counters on their creatures, put a 1-1 counter on each creature you control. So, that sounds like there's a lot going on, but it's pretty easy. So first, I put counters on my guys, then we go around, everyone chooses individually, in order, whether they're putting counters on their creatures, and then for each person that chose that, I get another 1-1 counter on each of my creatures.
Yep. So the person who's casting this doesn't ever make a decision.
Right.
It's just all the other players that make a decision.
Right. So if we have a 4-player game, if I cast it and Joe doesn't have any creatures, so he doesn't want to put counters on anything, obviously. But then Johnny is playing a token deck, and so he wants counters on all his creatures. And then the other guy is like, sure, I'll put counters on my creatures. So then at that point, you'd get 2 more counters on your creatures.
Yep, and this is a fun card that... All the Tempting Offer cards are these fun cards that allow for some politicking, because, like, if I'm ahead, you know, people may say, oh, we shouldn't put counters on our guys because we don't want to make him too powerful. And because each player has to make the decision in order, there's some opportunity for the last person to make a decision to backstab everybody else and be like, all right, you guys said that you didn't want counters. I'm going to take the counters. And
yeah, whatever. He can have 1 more set of counters on his creatures.
Yeah. So let me ask you a quick rules question here.
Sure.
What happens if I cast Quicken and cast Tempt with Glory at the end of your turn?
Uh-huh. So then we'll proceed in actual APNAP order, so it might start not at the person after who's casting Tempt with Glory. It'll start at the person starting with the active player and then proceeding from there in turn order.
Yeah. So if you're on my right, you'll actually make the first decision, and then the person on my left will make the second decision.
Well,
and third decision.
I won't make the decision because it's my spell.
No. Sorry. I'm casting this with Quicken during your end step.
Right. So yeah. So I would make the first decision, and then it would go from there.
Yeah.
But it'll probably jump at least once, so.
Yeah.
All right. So that's that. So unexpectedly absent, XYY instant, put target non-land permanent into its owner's library just beneath the top X cards of that library. Very odd wording. They could have put X cards from the top or whatever, but I guess they figure this is the most intelligible. But basically it means you count out X cards from the top of that library and then stick the target underneath it. So if it's 0, it goes on the top.
Yep.
Easy enough.
Yeah, and this is the first of the cards that you might actually see when you're judging a tournament that is actually sanctioned. This is a potentially legacy playable card because it has the potential to deal with not just creatures, but artifacts, enchantments, planeswalkers, any permanent other than a land.
Right.
And this is in the classic sort of like submerge type of removal of, oh, I put this on top of your deck, but I'm doing it in response to you shuffling, and so it's actually a heart removal spell.
Right. And just to note that if you put someone's commander on top of into their library, they can't choose to put it back in the command zone instead. And if you put a token into someone's library, it actually goes into the library, but then it ceases to exist. So it basically, it goes in for anything that cares about something being, like, put into a library, but then it's not actually going to take up any space in the library.
Yep. And so the number one judge call I expect to hear about this card is, you know, I'm judging a legacy tournament and I have a Jace the Mind Sculptor out and I say, okay, I'm going to crack my Flooded Strand to search for a card. And my opponent says, oh, in response, I'm going to unexpectedly absent your Jace the Mind Sculptor. And I'm going to call a judge and I'm going to say, judge, can I fail to find with my Flooded Strand and therefore leave the Jace on top of my library? And what would you say to that?
You can certainly fail to find. It would also depend, well, it would depend on how they phrase the question, because yes, they can fail to find, but the search itself is not optional.
Yeah, so the very specific rules interaction is of how this works is, okay, unexpectedly absent, puts the Jace on top of the library, then we resolve the Flooded Strand, and Flooded Strand doesn't say you may search your library, it says you search your library, so you always search, you always shuffle, and whether you find something or not, you're still searching or shuffling, which is different from cards like Path to Exile or Ghost Quarter that say you may search your library for a blah, 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 and it's only if you choose to search for it that you actually search and then shuffle.
Right, so the main thing is look for you may search versus just search.
Yep.
All right, so...
So that's the white cards. Shall we move on to blue?
Yeah, the curse is pretty much the same as we discussed with white. Diviner Spirit, 4 and a blue for a 2/4. When it deals combat damage to a player, you and that player each draw that many cards. So if you somehow get it to deal damage to you with something like, say, Harm's Way or something, you will draw twice as many cards as it deals damage to you.
Yep.
Because yay. But beyond that, it calculates based on how much damage it actually does, and you draw. It triggers when it deals the damage. And it doesn't matter if its power is then increased or decreased in response to the ability going on the stack. Or whatever.
Yep, this is just a sort of... This is an ability that we've seen before on Cold-Eyed Selkie. It works exactly the same, and like it's worked fine past. I do want to talk very quickly about Curse of Inertia, which is the blue curse, because this is an interesting thing in that it's targeting. So Curse of Inertia says, whenever a player attacks enchanted player with one or more creatures, that attacking player may tap or untap target permanent of his or her choice. So this is a weird case where the person who controls the ability is not the person who chooses the target. So if I control Curse of Inertia and Charlotte is attacking Dave, a third player, when the Curse of Inertia goes on the stack, Charlotte's going to pick the targets, and she can choose something that I control that has hexproof and actually target it because it's my permanent, a source from my permanent that is targeting it.
That is kind of a weird interaction. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, good to note.
Yeah. Just a weird, fun thing for Judge Trivia. So let's talk a little bit about the exchange rules, because this next card has the word exchange, and that's kind of a special word in Magic parties.
Right. We did touch on it a bit with Serene Master, but...
Yep. So then the next card is Djinn of Infinite Deceits. It's 4 blue-blue for a 2/7 creature Djinn with flying, and it has tap, exchange control of 2 target non-legendary creatures. You can't activate this ability during combat.
Right. So, well, first of all, the restriction is you can't activate it at any point during your combat, during a combat phase. So anytime from beginning of combat through end of combat, no go. But beyond that, yeah, you don't have to control either of the targets. You can choose just 2 other random creatures that are on the battlefield that 2 other people control just to mess with them. Oh, you're playing a Xur deck and you're playing a, you know, Kresh deck. Here, you guys switch those guys because those work so well in the other deck, right?
Well, not those specific guys, because they're legendary.
Well,
but some other creatures.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. My brain just, yeah, okay. Non-legendary analogs. There we
yeah.
go.
But so the thing I want to talk about with exchange is that it has its own specific meaning in magic parlance. When you perform an exchange, you only perform the exchange if both cards are still there, both things are still there. Mm-hmm. So you can exchange things like power or toughness or life totals or stuff like that too. So it's not just cards. So if one of the cards gains shroud, one of the things that's being targeted gains shroud, the exchange doesn't happen because it's no longer a legal target.
Or if it becomes legendary.
Or if it leaves...
If it leaves the battlefield, if it changes zones, if it, you know, gains protection from blue.
Yeah. And so there's no way with this for you to, I put this on the stack and then I bounce my creature and I steal your creature. You can't do that because it's an exchange and they both have to be there and you have to actually be able to complete the exchange for it to actually resolve. And that's just what exchange means in magic rules parlance.
Right. Absolutely. Illusionist's Gambit says a whole lot, but it's pretty easy when you get down to it. So I don't think that really bears too much discussion.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a cool card, but you people can figure out what it does pretty easily. Same with Order of Succession.
Yep. This is another one that cares about left or right.
Yep.
And it's not an exchange. So I'm going to read it very quickly. Choose left or right, starting with you and proceeding in the chosen direction. Each player chooses a creature controlled by the next player in that direction. Each player gains control of the creature he or she chose. You're not exchanging anything. You're just gaining control of stuff it doesn't target. So if the person to your left or right, whichever is chosen, doesn't have any creatures, you're going to get screwed by it.
Right. All right. Tempt with Reflections. So this is another tempting offer card, 3 and a blue. Choose target creature you control, put a token onto the battlefield that's a copy of that creature. Each opponent may put a token onto the battlefield that's a copy of that creature. For each opponent who does, put a token onto the battlefield that's a copy of that creature.
It's right of replication, sort of.
Ish.
Not really.
Kind of, yeah. Now, the main thing I wanted to touch on with this is... Just note that there would be 3 sets of tokens entering the battlefield at maximum. So your token is going to come in, then everyone's going to choose whether or not they get a token, then everyone who chose to get a token's token comes in simultaneously. Then for each of those, you get another set of tokens. And this is all during the resolution, but it's important for, you know, if let's say I'm targeting, you know, a Soul Warden, it's pretty important, you know, because, so my Soul Warden's going to see, you know, the token Soul Warden come in, and then both of those Soul Wardens will see however many opponents' Soul Wardens come in, and then, you know, all those will see the last set of tokens that come in.
Yeah, they're not, despite this all happening during the resolution of a spell and nobody checking state-based actions between these things, they are coming in a sequence. And so it does matter for that.
Right, but it's also important to note that the opponents choosing whether or not they get a creature, all of their tokens come in one action. They don't come in, it's not the person to my left and the person to his left and the person to their left getting a token in sequence.
Right, they choose in sequence and then they all enter the battlefield at the same time.
Right. You wanted to touch on Tidal Force?
Sure. So I this is near and dear to my heart because I really love the Force cycle. I'm glad that they're finishing it out. It's 5 blue for a creature elemental. It's a 7/7, and it says at the beginning of each upkeep, you may tap or untap target permanent. So they finished out the cycle of Verdant Force, Celestial Force, Magmatic Force with Tidal Force and Baleful Force in blue and black. And these guys are just cool big fatties. This one is another one that we may see some legacy play just as something to cheat in. It has some potential to replace Tidespout Tyrant in reanimator decks just as a non-legendary thing that bounces problematic permanents.
It taps. It doesn't bounce.
Tap. Sorry. Blah. You know, it's an interesting card, but it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, just again, the trigger, you choose whether to tap or untap as it resolves. You do have to target something, though.
Yeah, and this is one of those cards that you need to watch out for on Magic Online, because, if the, it'll ask you whether you want to do this when you resolve the trigger. And so, like, if you were tapping something that was untapped in response to your opponent taps it, you don't want to say yes to that on Magic Online because then it'll untap it.
Right. Because you can't tap a tapped an already tapped thing, and you can't untap an already untapped thing. So the ability is basically asking, do you wish to toggle this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. True Name Nemesis. This is sort of the biggie for the set. So one blue-blue, creature Merfolk Rogue, 3-1. As True Name Nemesis enters the battlefield, choose a player.
That's pretty straightforward. That's the rest of the card. 3-1, so we're done.
Choose a player, done. Interesting card, random choice, player choice, whatever. No. True Name Nemesis has protection from that player. What?
Yeah. So protection from player is brand new ability. This is just like when Progenitus came out in Conflux, and we
protection from everything.
Yeah, we had something that looked like a previous ability because we've got protection, but we're actually redefining and creating a new ability. It sounds like it. So when this got spoiled, everybody's like, what does that mean? And it has this nice reminder text that actually deals with a lot of this. It says in the reminder text, this creature can't be blocked, targeted, dealt damage, or enchanted by anything controlled by that player.
Yeah.
And so sort of unpacking it a bit, we've gotten some of the actual rules from Matt Tabak in the Commander 2013 FAQ. They've created a new ability. It's called Protection from a Player.
Yeah.
And it basically says anything that player controls or is not controlled by anybody but is owned by that player, you have protection from.
Right.
So the True Name Nemesis, if we use the DET acronym, it can't be damaged by that player or sources that player controls.
All damage is prevented.
Right.
Which is important if someone does a skull crack or similar type effect.
Absolutely. It can't be enchanted. Also, E stands for equipped and fortified if it somehow became
a land.
It can't be blocked by permanents controlled by that player.
Yep.
And it can't be targeted by that player or sources that player controls or spells that player controls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. It's just important, yeah. I mean, it's weird, but it's pretty straightforward once you figure out what it means.
Yeah, this is another one of those cases of they've done something that's kind of wordy and actually requires a lot of plumbing on the back end, but is actually going to make a lot of sense to people when they read it.
It's basically protection from your stuff.
The one other thing to note with this is that it's not a trigger when it enters the battlefield. It's a replacement effect to choose a player, so there's no shields down moment when this comes in where you can say, ha ha, I Doomblade this in response. You can't do that.
Not so much, yeah.
As it enters, so there's no time when you haven't picked a player while it's in play.
Yeah. All right. Baleful Force, 5, black, 7/7, creature elemental. At the end of each upkeep, you draw a card and lose one life. Main point I want to make, not optional. You can't choose to not do it just because you don't want to die.
Yep.
You take your medicine.
And you like it.
Yeah.
So I think we could probably skip Curse of Shallow Graves and Bell Shepherd.
Yeah, they're pretty basic. Hooded Horror, we can probably cover in one sentence. So Hooded Horror can't 4/4 for 4 and a black, can't be blocked if defending player controls the most creatures or is tied for the most. So that's only determine whether that's the case or not when you go to declare blockers, not at any time before or after that. And if, you know, that number changes, you know, before or after, it doesn't matter. It's only whether it was true or not at the time that blockers were chosen.
Yeah, and there are a couple other cards that are doing this counting thing in this set that care about the person that has the most of X or Y. And so it's when you're making the appropriate choice or during the resolution of that ability that you do that counting and make the determination.
Yep. Let's see. Ophiomancer is pretty easy, except that it's an intervening if clause. So Ophiomancer says, at the beginning of each upkeep, if you control no snakes, put a 1/1 black snake creature token with death touch onto the battlefield. Intervening if clause, so it won't trigger if you control any snakes at all at the beginning of your upkeep, and it won't trigger, and it won't do anything on resolution if you happen to somehow control a snake when it goes to resolve. So if you control two Ophiomancers, it doesn't really do anything for you.
Yeah.
Unless you have some way to sacrifice it in the interim, but
Or if you have a conspiracy out on thralls and all your snakes are actually thralls and not snakes, and oh my god, so many snakes.
Yeah, except, no, that's right, conspiracy doesn't actually change text, right? So
conspiracy replaces the creature type as opposed to xenograft, which is the one from New Phyrexia, which adds it.
Right.
Unfortunately, you can't, I don't think you can artificial evolution Ophiomancer himself to change one of the snakes word into something else. You change them both, so that's not a wombo combo. But you can conspiracy to get lots of not snake snakes from Ophiomancer.
Right. Yep. Fun times. Price of Knowledge is easy and fun. Tempt with Immortality, it's another tempting offer card. It doesn't target anything.
So Tempt with Immortality, it's 4 and a black for a sorcery. Tempting Offer, return a creature card from your graveyard to the battlefield. Each opponent may return a creature card from his or her graveyard to the battlefield. For each player who does, return a creature card from your graveyard to the battlefield.
Right, so no targets. No targets. Now, unlike the other Tempting Offer cards, it's not just a simple choice of yes or no for each opponent, because in this case, if the player chooses to return something, they have to declare what they're returning, right? They have to choose what they're returning at as they go around, and then everything is returned simultaneously.
Yep.
Well, again, it's three waves again, but...
Yeah, so all the decisions, so you make your decision for the first creature card, it's returned to the battlefield. Then each of the other players make their decisions in turn order of, am I going to do this, and which creature am I going to return?
Right.
And then all those are returned simultaneously. And then finally, you make your decision for each of the times that your opponents did it, which creatures you're returning, and then all those return simultaneously.
Yep.
So we have three waves here, and... You know, there's some fun shenanigans that can happen with the Mimeoplasm that can exile cards as it's entering the battlefield. So, like, if you return a Mimeoplasm as the first one, you can exile some cards in your opponent's graveyard so that they can't choose them when it's time for them to make their choices.
Right.
Which is kind of fun interaction.
Yeah. Toxic Deluge, 2 and a black sorcery. As an additional cost to cast Toxic Deluge, pay X life. All creatures get minus X until end of turn. Just easiest thing, the X life is an additional cost, so it's paid when you cast the spell. If the spell gets countered, you've still lost that life.
Yep, and it's one of the decisions you make when you're declaring the spell. You know, I'm going to pay X life for this.
Toxic Deluge, X is 5, you know, whatever.
That's also X is 10. Kill your progenitus.
That's another card that you might see in Legacy.
Yeah, I think we're up to 3 now. We've got that and True Name Nemesis and the Unexpected Absence.
Yep. All right.
So I'd like to talk about From the Ashes. I think this is a pretty sweet sorcery.
Sure. Go ahead.
So it's 3 and a red sorcery. Destroy all non-basic lands. For each land destroyed this way, its controller may search his or her library for a basic land card and put it onto the battlefield. Then each player who searched his or her library this way shuffles it.
Sure.
Okay. So some of the things that happen here are you're making a decision for each of the lands whether you want to search your library for a basic land to replace it. You only shuffle your library once, no matter how many basic lands you searched out.
Uh-huh.
If there's some effect that controls whether or not you can search a part of your library, whether you can search at all, that's going to take effect. So if you have an Aven Mind Sensor out and a From the Ashes out, your opponent's going to, and you cast From the Ashes, your opponent's only going to be able to search the top 4 cards for basic lands for all of the non-basics that are destroyed.
You're evil.
That's a fun thing to do, right? Everybody's having fun here. We're playing Magic. Well, I'm playing Magic. You're not playing Magic, but I'm having fun.
Yeah. Okay. So that about covers that. Let's see. Sudden Demise, X and a red sorcery. Choose a color. Sudden Demise deals X damage to each creature of the chosen color. You don't declare the color until the spell goes to resolve, so you could be very political when you cast this, and, you know, like, you can just, all you have to declare when you cast it is the value for X.
Yep, this is a good way to maybe make that blue player, you know, spend a counterspell to stop you, or to like trick them and be like, all right, we're going to take care of this green white tokens player. Don't counter my sudden demise. And then they let it resolve, and you're like, oh, blue.
Oh, sorry. All your creatures died. Oh, I'm so sorry. Wait, no, I'm not. All right. Sure. So, Tempt of the Vengeance. We've covered all of that stuff before. Terror Ravager is fun when you get extra attack steps, but we don't need to talk about it. Widespread Panic. This is one that I've actually gotten a lot of questions about on my Tumblr. So, Widespread Panic. 2 and a red. Whenever a spell or ability causes its controller to shuffle his or her library, that player puts a card from his or her hand on top of his or her library. So, the main question is the card shuffled in or not? And it's like, no. Because it actually only triggers when the shuffling happens. And so this card is going to go on top of a freshly shuffled library.
Yep.
And if someone casts, say, a Green Sun Zenith, which technically makes them shuffle twice, they're putting two cards on top.
Yeah, that was going to be my question for you.
Yeah, fun test. Yes.
So you definitely want to, when you're resolving a spell or ability with this on the battlefield, you want to definitely look and see how many times it has the word shuffle in it and how many times it's applicable. And, you know, if we go back to From the Ashes, which we were discussing before, that one only makes you shuffle once, even if, like, you lose 10 lands and get 10 mountains or whatever.
Yeah, seems good. Although I think Green Sun Zenith is only the only card that makes you shuffle twice, but...
I feel like there's at least one other one.
Hmm. We'll have to look that up. I'll get you guys the answer for that in the next episode.
Yeah, I think there's at least one land search card that has, like, threshold or some other thing that checks a condition that, like, lets you search for something, shuffle your library, and then lets you search again. And this was before we had the good templating of, and then for each player that searched their library this way, shuffle their library. They just had to shuffle each individual line, but
yep.
We can check.
Shuffle, and shuffle some more. All right. Witch Hunt.
This is an enchantment. It's 4 and a red, and it says, players can't gain life. That's awesome.
No, sir.
So, I'm a red mage, obviously, so I don't like
Yeah, but I like gaining life.
Yeah. You're clearly a white mage. At the beginning of your upkeep, Witch Hunt deals 4 damage to you. That doesn't sound that great. But it also says, at the beginning of your end step, target opponent chosen at random gains control of Witch Hunt. So what's going to happen with this is, I'm going to cast Witch Hunt, and then I'm going to go to my end step, and I'm going to say, all right, somebody randomly gets this, and it's not me, because I'm not my own opponent. And when that person starts their turn, they're going to take 4 damage in their upkeep, and then maybe give it away, or they'll definitely give it away during their end step, but it may not come back to me, it may go to somebody else.
Right, and the target is chosen when it goes on the stack, so people will know who's going to be getting control of it, so that if they have, like, stifle effects or whatever,
yeah,
or if they want to give themselves Shroud or Hexproof or whatever.
This is a fun combo with Azorius Guildmage. I'm going to counter that triggered ability, or that. Oh, wait, no, Azorius Guildmage only does activated abilities.
Yeah. Blah.
Curses. Foiled again. Ooh, can I do this with Strionic Resonator if I don't... Yeah, I can copy the trigger with Strionic Resonator.
So the same person gains control of it twice.
Are the targets the same?
I guess you may choose new targets. I guess you could choose to have it... to have another random target. I think we actually will have to ask someone about that.
Yeah.
What happens with Strionic Resonator, the Witch Hunt trigger? The second one.
Not that that matters, though, because the Strionic Resonator activated ability will go on top of the stack of the original trigger. And then, you know, so I'll give it to Charlotte, and then it'll go to David, because...
Yeah, but it's an interesting theoretical question.
Yeah. All right, we're coming up with questions for Tayback about this.
I'll let you ask him that one.
All right, awesome.
Okay, sure. So
on to the green.
Yeah, woo.
So next up, we've got Bane of Progress. It's 4 green for a 2/2 creature elemental. When Bane of Progress enters the battlefield, destroy all artifacts and enchantments. Put a +1/+1 counter on Bane of Progress for each permanent destroyed this way. So it does care about whether they get destroyed or not. So if, you know, you have a Darksteel Colossus out and Bane of Progress tries to destroy it but fails because Darksteel Colossus has indestructibility, it's not going to get a +1/+1 counter for that.
Or if it gets generated, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Bane of Progress, not very good against Dark Steel Forge, mm-hmm. is what we're learning. But it doesn't care if it actually went to the graveyard or not. So if there's a Leyline of the Void out, or a Rest in Peace out, or something else that moves stuff that causes things that would go to the graveyard to go to exile.
Sun and Moon.
Yeah. Or perhaps more relevantly, if your opponent has an Artifact Commander and they decide instead of putting it into their graveyard to put it into the command zone, it still is getting destroyed, and so the Bane of Progress is still going to get +1/+1 counter from that.
Sure. Naya Soul Beast. It's a 0/0 for 6/2 green. That really fails the vanilla test.
Yeah, I want a little bit more from my 8 drops.
little more than nothing? Come on.
Yeah, this is...
It has trample.
It's not Wood Elemental. Ooh, trample. See, there we go. 0/0 trample.
But we can get 8/0 trample for 3 mana.
That's true.
Anyway, when you cast Naya Soul Beast, each player reveals the top card of his or her library. Naya Soul Beast enters the battlefield with X +1/+1 counters on it, where X is the total converted mana cost of all cards revealed this way.
Yeah, so it's interesting to note this is a trigger that occurs when you cast it, not when it would enter the battlefield, or a replacement effect when it enters the battlefield, or anything like that.
It's a really bad reanimation target.
Yeah, not a good reanimation target, not what you want to put on show and tell, but also your opponents are going to know how big it's going to be
right.
while it's on the stack, so they can make a decision, an educated decision, with their counterspells or force rules.
Oh, that's going to be an 8-mana 3/3? Sure, have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This card doesn't look that exciting to me.
Not really, no.
Yeah.
No.
But then there's going to be that game when your opponent's like, oh, I have a Kozilek on top of my library. Oh, I have an Ulamog on top of my library. Oh, my God.
Oh, I have an Eldrazi Conscription on top of my library.
Fun stuff.
Fun stuff, indeed. All right. Primal Vigor. Born a green. This is sort of a fixed doubling season. If one or more tokens would be put onto the battlefield, twice that many of those tokens are put onto the battlefield instead. Yay, awkward sentences. If one or more +1/+1 counters are placed on a creature, twice that many +1/+1 counters are placed on that creature instead.
So the things that are interesting to note with this are that, one, it's global. So it's not just your stuff, it's any of your opponent's stuff as well.
Yep.
And two, it doesn't care about whether it's an effect or a replacement ability or a trigger or whatever.
It doesn't care about why, it just cares that it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Which kind of deals with some of the complexities that you had with doubling season that were a little bit confusing about when exactly it would happen or not.
Yeah.
And it also cuts out the problem that it had with planeswalkers by just affecting +1/+1 counters.
Right. Although, I don't know why it couldn't just be counters on a creature, but then, you know, you could still make your planeswalker a creature, but the biggest issue with doubling season and planeswalkers is that it lets you ultimate a lot of them immediately, which is the big problem, right?
Yeah, I think there's probably just some feel bad with -1/-1 counters.
Sure.
That you don't want, that you just want to make this all upside.
Or say Myogens with double divinity counters, or...
Yeah. If you did it for, you know... Yeah. Yeah, there are lots of weird things that can happen. And they basically just said, let's do the simplest form of this card that
people
does
like.
What people expect and want and like.
Right. That's fair. All right. Restore does not bear mention, although it's a card you might see in Legacy. Maybe.
Yeah.
Although Crucible of Worlds only costs 1 more mana and lets you have, like, at least the same effect. Although it doesn't let you steal cards out of other people's graveyards.
Yeah, and so Restore, it's 1 in a green for a sorcery. Put target land card from a graveyard onto the battlefield under your control.
It also doesn't use your land drop.
That's a big thing. That it's a little bit cheaper. Like this might see some play in Legacy, like maybe in the sideboard of Rug Delver for the Delver Mirror that, you know, your opponent wastelands you. Well, then you play a wasteland from their graveyard and wasteland them, or you get double wasteland.
Yeah.
Otherwise, probably doesn't have that many applications. Like, it's really just wasteland that you care about in Legacy. But it's kind of cool in Commander. One thing to note with Commander is that even if you manage to steal a land from somebody's graveyard that normally would produce a color that isn't in your color identity, it will not produce that color. It'll produce colorless. Yeah. So, you know, I have my Godo Bandit Warlord deck, and you have your Iona Shield of Emeria deck. I'm like, all right, let's get your Emeria the Sky Ruin out of your graveyard, because I strip mined it before. I guess I'm probably not playing Godo and Restore.
okay.
So I have my Roisin Meanderer deck.
Sure.
Okay.
But there's no X on Restore.
That's true.
Flavor fail.
So if I steal your Emeria the Sky Ruin from your graveyard, it's going to tap for colorless. It's not going to tap for white.
Right. Yep, fair enough. Okay, Spawning Grounds, 6 green-green, enchant land. Enchanted land has tap, put a 5/5 green beast creature token with trample onto the battlefield. It's the land that has the ability, so if you're, like, Pithing Needle or whatever, you need to name the land that it's on, not Spawning Ground. That's the main thing.
And if you put this on your opponent's land, you're not going to be able to tap it for them to get a beast. They're going to be like, oh, thanks a lot. I'm going to make a beast.
Yep. Tempt with Discovery lets you get lands with a tempting offer, and again, 3-part process, etc. We've covered all of these already, so.
Yeah, so just with Tempt with Discovery, I want to talk about very quickly. So it says, search your library for a land card, put it on the battlefield. Each opponent may search his library for a land card and put it on the battlefield. For each opponent that searched their library this way, search your library for a land card and put it onto the battlefield. Then each player who searched the library this way shuffles it. So again, we see this magnificent, everybody only shuffles one tech, which I love, and thank you, Temple Flooding Gods, for. But also, it's not just whether somebody chose to search a land or not that you get the information on. When they search, you get to see that land before the next level decision. So
right.
I search, you get to see what land I put on, then each of the players say, I'm going to search.
Right. And even if they don't find a land, like if you have, say, your, the Mind Sensor out.
Even Mind Sensor? Yeah.
Yeah. If you have your Even Mind Sensor out and they're like, sure, I'll see if I have a land in these top 4 cards, and they don't, you still get to search for a land because they searched their library.
And so they're going to know what land you found.
You know what land they found.
You're going to know what land they found, but they're not going to know what lands each of them are finding.
Right. Because they all search simultaneously. It's like show and tell.
Yeah. Which could have been really weird with the old legend rules, because people are going to be like, oh, I'm going to get, you know, Pendlehaven, and I'm going to get I don't think Pendlehaven's really what they want. Urborg, maybe?
Urborg, or...
Yeah.
Well, no, I guess Flagstones of Trocare would be fine, because then they each get extra lands, but whatever.
Yeah, but we don't have to worry about that with the new legendary rule.
Yeah, new legend rule. Yeah, let's just reiterate. New legend rule, everyone gets to control one of each legend now, so yay.
Yeah. But, like, they don't know that you got your strip mine and are going to get them, for example.
Exactly. So, yeah, so each opponent will choose a land. Then once everyone's chosen their land, they put it onto the battlefield, and they can't change their mind then.
Yeah. And then the person who cast it gets to make their final decisions.
Yep. Alrighty. On to the multicolored. And these are all the new legends. So, yay.
Yeah. These guys are all 3-color legends in each of the shards, right?
Yep. So, Derevi, Imperial Tactician, green, white, blue, 2/3 flyer, legendary bird wizard. So flying, when he enters the battlefield or a creature you control attacks.
It's actually when it deals combat damage.
Oh, sorry.
Not when it attacks.
Sorry. Deals combat damage. So, I'm sorry. It is late. I'm tired. So when Derevi, Imperial Tactician, enters the battlefield or a creature you control deals combat damage to a player, you may tap or untap target permanent. That's easy enough. Same thing as we talked about before, it's a toggle, so if they can do something in response, you will just want to choose to not do it. But I mean, in Commander, generally, just, you know, you say whether you want it to be tapped or untapped at the end, and you're good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's mainly just a Magic Online concern.
Yeah, and then activated ability, 1 green, white, blue, put Derevi onto the battlefield from the command zone. So yay, so Derevi's never really going to cost you more than 4. From your command zone. Also note that that's an activated ability, and it's not casting it, so it can't be counterspelled. It can be stifled, though.
Yep. Although if they stifle it, you can just say, oh, I'm going to pay it again.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And you can do it at any time because there's no active timing restrictions on it.
Yeah, so this is a very resilient commander. You know, you can't ever get rid of it unless you manage to shuffle into your opponent's library. Mm-hmm. It also sidesteps one of the main sort of anti-commander cards, Hinder, which is a counterspell that puts the counterspell on top of their library or on the bottom of their library. It gets around that by using an activated ability to jump out.
Right.
And, like, there are all sorts of cool shenanigans with this. I haven't figured out exactly what I want to do other than, like, give my guys pseudo-vigilance.
Yeah.
But it feels like there's all sorts of sneaky things you could do mm-hmm. with Derevi.
Well, yeah, and I mean, like, and just the fact that since he untaps something, he costs a virtual 3 every time you put him on the battlefield anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, so you want to cover Gahiji?
Yes, Gahiji, the Honored One. 2 white, green, red, so Naya colors.
2 Naya,
legendary creature beast. It's a 4/4, and he says, whenever a creature attacks one of your opponents or planeswalker an opponent controls, that creature gets +2/+0 until end of turn. So he's sort of like an attacking double Orcish Aura Flame.
Attack that guy, not me.
He incentivizes other people to get attacked and not you.
Yeah.
He's kind of like almost like the stick to the carrot. Oh, why can't I remember his name? There's a blue green commander that they printed in the last set that people get to draw cards when they hit your opponents.
Oh yeah, Edric.
Yes, Spymaster of Trust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Who's just kind of nasty as a commander anyway, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. So yeah. So that's. So it triggers for everyone else's stuff. You don't get to choose whether the creature gets it or not. It's automatic.
Yeah, he just likes carnage.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of turns sideways.
Yep.
So next up, we've got Jaleva, Nephalia's Scourge.
Ooh, this is a spicy one. 1 blue, black, red, so 1 in Grixis. Legendary creature, vampire wizard. Ooh, 1/3 flying. When Javala enters the battlefield, each player exiles the top X cards of his or her library, where X is the amount of mana spent to cast Jaleva. When Jaleva attacks, you may cast an instant or sorcery card exiled with it, without paying its mana cost.
Yep, so this is part of a cycle of commanders that care about the amount of mana that you spent on them?
It's not a full cycle. There's a couple color combinations that didn't get one, but there's like 3 or 4 of them in the set.
Yeah.
Like, there's not an Esper one.
You're right.
Yeah, anyway.
But there are a couple other ones that care about this stuff.
I think it's 3, actually. There's Jaleva, Prosh, and Marath, and I think that's it. Anyway, the amount of mana you spent to cast her is exactly that. How much mana did you actually pay? If something's letting you cast her without paying her mana cost, or giving you a discount, that's all taken into account. If something is making you pay more, say the commander tax, that's also taken into account.
Yep. So if I have a Helm of Awakening out, which reduces the cost of spells everybody casts by 1, then she'll exile 3 when I cast it the first time.
Right.
If you have a Sphere of Resistance out, or, a Lodestone Golem out that increases the cost of things by 1, you'll get 5.
Right. If this is the, fourth time I've cast her out of my, command zone, everyone will exile 10,
Yep. The other thing to note with Jaleva is that each time she enters the battlefield and exiles cards, she can only cast cards that were exiled that time.
Right.
So if she leaves the battlefield, she gets flickered or she dies and goes to the command zone, the ones that she exiled before just stay in exile and she can't refer to them ever again.
Right. Anytime an object changes zones, it's a new object with no relation to its previous existence. This is actually something players are needing to learn for current standard now that Nightvale Spectre is becoming a well-played card.
Yep.
But, I think people are catching on, which is a good thing. Yep, so Jaleva. All right, you want to talk about Marath?
Yes, Marath, Will of the Wild, is a legendary creature elemental beast. It's a 0/0. It says, Marath, Will of the Wild, enters the battlefield with a number of +1/+1 counters on it equal to the amount of mana spent to cast it. So same thing we were talking about before. If something increases the cost, like casting it multiple times for the command zone, it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it has an activated ability. It says, X, remove X plus one counters from Marath. X cannot be zero. And you get to choose one, so this is a modal activated ability.
Ooh, modal.
The first mode is put X plus one counters on target creature. The second is Marath deals X damage to target creature or player. The third is put an XX green elemental creature token onto the battlefield. And again, X can't be zero. And this is one of the two cards that was errated. So it's actually, it's not printed with the X can't be zero, but is considered to have that, and this, you know, it's just an unfortunate thing that, you know, it got misprinted without that line of text. They obviously meant it to be there, because otherwise there are, like, a bunch of really absurd two-card infinite combos with it.
All have, you know, any sort of anthem effect or any effect that cares about creatures dying and make infinite 0/0 tokens. Woo!
Yep.
You know, or I'll just have Master of Waves out, and, well, I mean, you can't play Master of Waves in a Marath deck, but whatever. Maybe you're playing a Nephilim deck. I don't know.
We're playing our Progenitus deck, and we happen to get Marath and Master of Waves out.
Sure. Yay. Let's make all the infinite 1/1 elementals. All right. Nekusar, the Mind Razor. 2BB/RB. So 2 and Grixis. Legendary creature, zombie wizard. I like it already. At the beginning of each player's draw step, that player draws an additional card. Yay. Whenever an opponent draws a card, Nekusar the Mind Razor deals 1 damage to that player. So you take your Howling Mind and you staple your Underworld Dreams to it, and you get this guy. Right?
Yep. It's kind of a, hey, everybody gets benefit from this, don't kill me because I've got this thing, but also secretly, take one.
Well, take two, technically.
Take two.
Yeah.
And it's a fun hoser for opponents that, you know, cast big Sphinx's Revelations or other, you know, Marine Geysers or whatever.
Enter the Infinite!
Yes.
Sure. Take 95? No, take... I don't know. By the time you're casting Enter the Infinite, it's probably take, what, 70?
Take 80.
70, 80, whatever.
Take your life total, probably.
Yeah.
Plus some.
Anyway, the effect is cool, but it's not all that complicated.
Yeah. Just, you know, this triggers whenever you draw a card, whenever your opponents draw a card, not just when they draw cards from Nekusar.
Right. And I mean, you just figure that all the new commanders deserve talking about in this, because they're the cards that people are going to be focusing on the most, probably, so.
Yeah. One thing I really like with this set is that all the commanders are actually pretty cheap.
Yeah. They're reasonably costed.
Yeah, I think the most expensive one is 6 mana.
6, yep.
As opposed to a lot of the commanders that we saw in the previous product, where there are some like 7s and 8s that were just kind of hard to cast. So mm-hmm. I like that they're getting both ends of this.
Yeah, you have to think about how much it's going to cost to cast a commander and how much it's going to cost to cast it the second time, right?
Yep.
Like if it's unreasonable to think that you'll be able to cast your commander twice in a game, then something's wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or that commander is just like really crazy.
Yeah, it's like, but anyway, we're getting off topic, so.
So next up, we've got Aloro, Ageless Ascetic. He's an Esper commander. He costs 3BB/BB, and he's a 4/5 legendary giant soldier. He's got a bunch of abilities. First ability is at the beginning of your upkeep, you gain 2 life, so you must like that.
Yay, life. I like life gain.
Then whenever you gain life, you may pay 1. If you do, draw a card, and each opponent loses 1 life. I like drawing cards.
That seems good, yeah.
And then it says, at the beginning of your upkeep, if Aloro, Ageless Ascetic, is in the command zone, you gain 2 life.
So you're gaining 2 life during your upkeep unless he got, like, tucked into your library, basically.
Yep.
Or got turned into something else and lost his abilities.
Or if he was in the command zone and then somehow made it out of the command zone while this ability was on the stack.
Yeah.
Because it is an intervening F. But so the thing to keep in mind with Aloro is that while you're pretty much gaining 2 life every turn during your upkeep, the draw card trigger where you can pay 1 only happens if he's on the battlefield.
Right. So abilities only function on the battlefield unless they specifically mention functioning in another zone or basically have to function in that zone.
Yeah. And then the other thing with this ability is that the paying the 1 only happens when the ability resolves. Whenever you gain life, you may pay one colorless mana. If you do draw a card, and each opponent loses one life. So you don't make that decision when you put the ability on the stack. You make that decision when the ability resolves.
Right. It also doesn't matter how much life you gain. It's still each instance of life, like each chunk of life gain is just one instance of gaining life. So if I hit you with three lifelink creatures and they deal 7 damage to you, he'll trigger 3 times. But, you know, he won't trigger 7 times.
Right. All right. What do we have next?
Krosh, Sky Raider of Kerr. 3 black, red, green, legendary creature, dragon. I like it. 5/5 flying. Because if he's a dragon, what else would he be? Right?
Yeah.
When you cast Prosh, Sky Raider of Kerr, put X01 red creatures tokens named Kobolds of Kerr Keep onto the battlefield, where X is the amount of mana spent to cast Prosh. Yay! So, just like the other guys that we talked about, how we determine X is based on what you actually spent. And sacrifice another creature, Prosh gets +1/+0 until end of turn.
Yep, he's a great stabilizing commander. He always comes with a bunch of chump blockers, and he can always pump himself up.
Yep, and they're Kobolds of Kerr Keep, so they actually interact with a couple of different cards.
Yeah, they interact with Rogar of Kerr Keep, and then there are a few cards that care about the Kobold subtype.
Yeah, so obviously if you're playing a Prosh deck, you'd want to get all the Kobolds you could, because Kobolds are awesome.
Yep, and luckily, the guy I just mentioned, gosh darn it, why can't I remember his name? I just said it.
Valoro?
No, the blank blank of Kerki.
Oh, Rogar.
Rogar of Kerki is a red green legend.
No, red black.
Red black?
Red black.
Well, he's the same. He's in the color.
Yes, you can definitely play him in your Prosh deck.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So yay, kobolds. Kobolds are awesome. All right.
So next up we have Rune of the Hidden Realm. This is a Bant commander. It's 2 white, blue, green for a legendary creature, Rhino Soldier. He's a 4/4 with vigilance and trample. And he's got an ability. He's got 2 tap to exile another target creature. Return that card to the battlefield under its owner's control at the beginning of the next end step. So you can use this ability to re-trigger enter the battlefield effects. You can also use it to temporarily save something from, like, a kill spell, including a Wrath of God, because it doesn't return immediately. It returns at the beginning of the next end step. Or you can use it to, like, get a blocker out of the way, or if your opponent has a problematic creature on the battlefield that you need to have off the battlefield or get summoning sick or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, sorry, one thing I needed to mention about Prosh that I didn't mention is his ability that makes tokens triggers when you cast him.
So, oh, yeah, it's not when he enters the battlefield.
No, so even if he's countered, you still get your kobolds.
Yep, that's true.
So that's important. And the kobolds are on the battlefield before he resolves. But, yes, so that's something I actually hadn't noticed until I just looked at him again. But, yeah, no, it triggers when you cast him. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty – it makes him even better, actually.
It does make it sweeter. It's a seldom seen sort of trigger.
It's the Eldrazi style trigger. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So next up, we've got the other Jund commander, Shattergang Brothers.
Whee! 1 black, red, green, 3/3, legendary Goblin Artificer. Ooh, Goblin Artificers are always fun. Because they're actually not very good artificers, usually.
Yeah, they're good at breaking things accidentally.
Yeah, well, except for, what was that, Slovat or whatever his name was. He was actually pretty decent. But.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, Shattergang Brothers has 3 abilities, and they're all really similar. So, 2 in a black, sack a creature. Each other player sacrifices a creature. 2 in a red, sacrifice an artifact. Each other player sacrifices an artifact. 2 in a green, sacrifice an enchantment. Each other player sacrifices an enchantment.
Yep, he goes and fixes your artifacts and,
yeah.
Oh, look, I made this better. It doesn't work anymore. Also, all your opponent's stuff doesn't work anymore.
I made your dude better. Oh, wait, no, I didn't. Oh, and this enchantment, I guess I messed it up somehow. But yeah, just one thing to mention with these guys is your opponent can't respond to you activating the ability by trying to get rid of whatever you're trying to sacrifice, because by the time you've activated it, it's too late.
Yep. Also, when they're going to choose which thing they sacrifice when the ability resolves, so it's not like,
yeah,
it's not targeted or anything. They can't, like blink out their creature or something like that, because it's when it resolves that they sacrifice.
Right. You can't immediate blink. They could use like rune, because rune has like the slow blink.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, also the sacrifice things are chosen in app order, so you'll know what everyone sort of before you is going to be sacrificing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, and on to our last multicolored card.
So this is Sidri, Galvanic Genius. It's our other Esper legendary creature. It's white, blue, black for a legendary human wizard. She's a 2/2. She has two abilities. For a single blue, you can, she says, target non-creature artifact becomes an artifact creature with power and toughness equal to its converted mana cost until end of turn. So she March of the Machines, a single artifact.
Or Karns, if you're old school.
Sure.
Yep.
And white-black, target artifact creature gains death touch and lifelink until end of turn.
Woo!
So she can spend her whole colors to make, you know, one of your non-creature artifacts into a lifelink death touch blocker or something like
yeah.
that.
Why isn't she an artificer, though?
I think artificers are more in the blue-red color pie.
Yeah.
But that is a little bit weird.
She seems like an artificer.
Yeah. I guess, like, she's actually just using magic on this stuff and yeah. not actually tinkering with
it. She doesn't actually make them. She just casts spells on them. Whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is Judge Cast North, not Flavor Cast, so.
Yeah, so we don't have Ben Stark on here to give us a ruling, a flavor ruling.
Oh.
One thing to note with this is that Sidri does not remove summoning sickness from the non-creature artifact when she animates it. Most of the time, you don't have to care about whether your non-creature permanents have been on the battlefield since the beginning of your turn. But if you turn a non-creature permanent into a creature permanent, it is going to care whether or not it's been on the battlefield since the beginning of your turn for purposes of tapping or attacking or stuff like
and
that.
Again, the whole becomes an artifact creature like we mentioned earlier. Doesn't remove any other types or subtypes or anything.
Yeah, so if I animate my Thassa's Bident, it's going yes. to be a legendary creature enchantment artifact.
I think it would be legendary artifact enchantment creature. But yeah.
Sure, with no subtypes, right?
Right.
Yeah. Fun stuff.
Yeah. So we're almost done. So on to the new artifacts. Eye of Doom! Doom, doom, doom. Doomy, doom, doom, doom. So, 4-mana artifact. When Eye of Doom enters the battlefield, each player chooses a non-land permanent and puts a Doom counter on it. And it's any non-land permanent. Doesn't have to be one they control.
Yep.
So it's like everybody gets to choose what they want to blow up eventually.
Yeah, typically you're going to choose a permanent you don't control on this, and this is an excellent opportunity to gang up on somebody that's really far ahead. Everybody's like, oh, that guy's about to win. Let's all put Doom counters on different ones of his stuff.
Right.
Let's
put Doom counters on all those auras on Earl or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so 2 tap sack, I have Doom. Destroy each permanent with a Doom counter on it. Now, just to note, when the card was originally spoiled, it was spoiled in Italian, and in Italian it uses the same word for Doom counter as it does for Fate counter. So just note that these are not Fate counters. This does not interact with Oblivion Stone or Triad of the Fates.
Do you know what it does interact with?
What does it interact with?
Armageddon Clock!
Armageddon Clock!
Yeah. Which only puts Doom counters on itself, so it's not actually very exciting.
Well, you can put an additional Doom counter on the Armageddon Clock.
Yeah. So one thing that's kind of interesting to note with Eye of Doom is that putting the Doom counters on things is not targeted. So that's, one, it's going to be, the permanents are going to be chosen when you resolve the Enter the Battlefield effect, but also you can put the Doom counters on things with Shroud or things with Hexproof. So you can just put it directly on your opponent's Earl, not on all the enchantments on it.
Right.
So it's a way for you to get around that stuff while only killing one permanent.
True enough, I suppose. That seems unfair for people who work very hard to make all their creatures hexproof.
Yeah, I'm not really going to shed any tears over those people.
Well, then, I know someone who's not getting invited back on the show.
Oh.
All right, next card.
Surveyor's Scope. It's an artifact for 2 mana, and it's got tap, exile, Surveyor's Scope. as a cost to search your library for up to X basic land cards, where X is the number of players who control at least two more lands than you. Put those lands onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. So this is another one of those counting cards that you're going to be counting on the resolution of the ability, not when you activate the ability. Right. So if your opponents decide to, like, wasteland each other and strip mine each other to have as many lands as you, then you're not going to get any lands out of it. I think you're probably happy with that.
Mm-hmm. And the lands enter untapped, just like they did with the destroy non-basic lands spell.
Yeah.
Yep. Let's see. And finally, we come to the new land, which is Opal Palace. Opal Palace taps for a colorless. Yay! It also has one tap, add to your mana pool one mana of any color in your commander's color identity. If you spend this mana to cast your commander, it enters the battlefield with a number of +1/+1 counters on it equal to the number of times it's been cast from the command zone this game. That's a mouthful. So basically, you can use it as a filter. You can use it as, like, a, you know, Unknown Shores or Shimmering Grotto or whatever. But if you use the mana that you filter through it to cast your commander comes in with counters for however many times it's been cast from your command zone. So if you're casting it from your command zone for the first time, it gets a counter. If you're casting it from your command zone for the fourth time, it gets four counters.
Yep. It's going to enter the battlefield with those counters, so it's not a trigger when it enters the battlefield, it just enters the battlefield with them.
Yep.
So it's always there with them. This card is not very good in non-commander formats because color identity is only true when you have a commander. So if you play this in Legacy, it's got the ability add one to your mana pool, and it's got the ability one tap, do nothing.
Yep.
Which honestly is better than Command Tower was in Legacy, so maybe this is an upgrade on the Commander lands for other formats?
Maybe. Although technically it also it does technically make your commander cost more to cast.
Because you're filtering.
Because you're filtering, so you're losing the Opal Palace's mana.
Yeah, it essentially says, I'm going to do some bad fixing for you, and I'm going to give you the ability to cast your, to, like, Orin Reef your commander, kind of.
Yeah, which isn't bad. I mean, it's very good with something like Marath, because, you know, Marath comes in with, like, you know, not quite double, but, you know.
Yeah, it's awesome with cheap commanders, especially cheap commanders that have some sort of beneficial, like, sacrifice ability, or they're just going to get into combat a bunch and die a bunch. One thing to note is if you're using this with Derevi Imperial Tactician, it's not going to count those times that you used her ability to put her on the battlefield from the command zone, that activated ability for one blue, green, white. It's only when you cast them from the command zone.
Right.
And it's also only counting the times that you actually cast it from command zone. So if you have a commander that got tucked into your library with a hinder, and then you draw it and you cast it with Opal, or you cast it with Opal Palette, or you just cast it in general, that's not going to count as one of the times it got cast from command zone.
You know, and if you spend it to put Derevi onto the battlefield, you don't get any counters.
Yeah.
Yep, so that wraps it up. I don't really think any of the reprints merit a whole lot of discussion that I can think of.
There's definitely some financial discussion going around about Baleful Strix, but, you know, that's neither here nor there for our rules discussion.
Whatever. It's a card. It's being printed again. Yay. Yeah. Anyway, so that's about it. So we've gone on for about an hour and a bit, so yeah. So thank you for being on the show, Joe. If anyone wants to get in touch with you, how can they do so?
So you can find me on Twitter at Joseph Bono. Also, I'm occasionally on Magic Online, also Joseph Bono. And I occasionally update a blog about, you know, various Magic-related things and some other life things. It's josephbono.wordpress.com. So, Joseph Bono in all places.
All times, all realities. All right, cool. So, yeah, so if anyone wants to email the show, we can be reached on Gmail, judgecastnorth@gmail.com. That's also our Twitter, @judgecastnorth. I'm personally on Twitter, @jackalgirl, JQLgirl. You can follow my Tumblr, which is magicjudge.tumblr.com. I answer lots of rules questions there. And, yeah, so that's about it. So
thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah, thank you.
I had a fun time.
Thanks. So, from everyone here at JudgeCast North, I'm Charlotte Sable. I keep it fair.
I'm Joe Bono, and I keep it Seattle-ish.
Yeah, that sounds fine. Good night.